Hello and welcome to Credit Shift News and Update. This week, I'm Paul Sweeney, co-founder and chief strategy officer here at Webio, and today I'm again joined by our CEO and co-founder, Cormac O'Neill.
Evening, hey, Paul.
Cormac. How are you doing?
And we will be exploring some of the recent news stories, events, reports, and trends in the credit industry. So before we kick off all that, Cormac, any updates from the wonderful world of Webio this week?
The wonderful world of Webio this week. Well, I guess, yeah, Paul, you and I were very fortunate to spend 2 days over in London by invitation of our friends in AGC Partners. Let's give them a quick plug. UK and US investment bank kindly invited us to a financial PEVC All Things Funding Summit in London for 2 days. 300 participants, really good event. One of the best that I think, Paul, you and I agreed, one of the best we've been at. Because of the quality of everybody that was there in terms of the companies and the, whether it's companies that were there, whether it was PE folks or alternative lenders, so to speak, and venture capital, is really, really good couple of days, some fantastic conversations. I know things for those of you in the startup world and anybody listening who may be out there looking for funding and all the rest, the news from the front is there's plenty of money out there, that's for sure, and plenty of funds looking for good homes. And a lot of very upbeat folks out there for the second half of this year was the sense I got. Now, that might have something to do with the nice cocktails they served us the evening before. I'm not sure. But there was definitely a positive vibe in the room. And it was great. We actually met a customer there, Paul, by pure chance. Do you remember that? Yeah, I'm sure you do remember it. That didn't mean to come out like that. But, you know, this was the next day. So we met a customer of theirs, but just by pure chance, which was very, very interesting. So, yeah, so that was it. A good couple of days in London. Sorry, go on.
No, what struck me was just the that old world charm of those buildings and the scale of them, the size of them, the history of them, and I guess the history of everyone involved in engineering, which is where we were, and all the statues around that area. Just kind of really makes you much more kind of present to just the deep history of the place. And as well, on the way out, Cormac, I kind of reflected on, I think there was over £200 billion under management in that room.
Absolutely. There was quite a bit, Paul, quite a bit. You know, hey, listen, never get tired of going to London. Never get tired of going to London. No. Fantastic city.
It was so interesting.
Yeah, it was. It's good couple of days. So it was hard work. We want our listeners to realize that we weren't over there in a jolly. This was hard work. So let's just be
clear. It was back-to-back stuff. Back-to-back stuff.
Back-to-back.
Okay, let's jump into some industry news. People are starting to come to an understanding that having done some kind of work in preparation for customer duty, that the world changes and people can be thrown into vulnerability quite suddenly. You can't imagine how much has changed day by day, and you've got to manage that. And the ability to measure and monitor that kind of change is being raised now as an ongoing concern for management across the credit industry. And one of the questions being raised is, do companies have an early warning system that anticipates harm by joining the dots across lots of different data sources? And this came up in a couple of our meetings in London, actually, Cormac. I don't think that people truly understand the depth of impact that the customer duty is going to have. And this came up in some of the reading this week in the last couple of days, where there's some people saying that the monitoring system for customer duty is going to have to be self-learning as well. It's not enough to just have a system in place to monitor. It's also going to be adaptive and learning. So I think we've a lot to see yet from the impact of customer duty.
Yeah, it did come up a couple of conversations we had last week, Paul. It certainly did. The other thing, look, this is coming up all the time now when we engage with customers. It's, you know, how can you help me? It's not so much stay compliant, but how can you help me monitor, as you said there, and evidence and track and report. They're the key things that we're hearing from our customers when we're engaging with them now. You know, it is certainly front and center of a lot of people's minds at the moment, and will continue to be. And it's something that we've factored into our product roadmap in terms of the insights we can give customers. You know, we had a session on this today internally, just around managing our data and how can we give access to it. Like, a lot of things that we would see on a regular basis is data requests from our customers, got to do with their customers, and how can we act on that as speedily and as much detail as we possibly can. Definitely something that we are super conscious of now in terms of when we're thinking of our product into the future. And that's been customer driven. When I say customer driven, our customer driven. And yeah, so this one is going to just keep going
and keep getting more and more serious. Mm. Okay, moving on to our next section of Buy Now, Pay Later, AI, and all things innovative technology. First item on the agenda, OpenAI gap closing. Companies that have wrapped their service around OpenAI's platform may have to do a bit more strategic reflection. Why? Well, other models, like closed models such as Claude and Inflection.ai, are approaching levels of performance that industry analyst Brett Kinsella is calling the good enough threshold, and often at a lower cost. In an era where generative AI strategies are going to be of major strategic importance, we are seeing the major cloud vendors move to a position where each of them will provide access to all the models you could need. Brett's article shows that there may be different types of personal assistant or co-pilot evolving with each model, and thus maybe not all models are the same, and maybe the best option is to mix and match them where you need them. So I think that's been a very interesting development over the last 2 weeks, Cormac. We're seeing the gap in model performance really come up to the 3.5 Turbo and OpenAI 4. But again, you know, we'll see OpenAI come out probably later half of this year, early next year, with their next generation of model. And no doubt that will move the expectation or the frontier forward yet again.
Yeah, look, this does it kind of remind you of breaking the 4-minute mile barrier that Roger Bannister broke? So once person does it, everybody starts doing it. Number one, they start to believe it can be done. And number two, to start working hard enough to get there. So I think that's what OpenAI has done. It's really, really focused the mind of everybody else in the marketplace, and huge resources have been thrown at this, you know, to catch up and to not fall too far behind. We're following the closed model approach. You know, our models are all closed. They're all owned by ourselves. Likewise, we're doing the same thing around different models being used for different use cases. That's exactly the framework that we've done here at Webio in terms of using different models to solve different problems. And how do you orchestrate those models? How do you know when to call on the right model, which is a big thing that we've been working on and solving here. So all of that chimes with us. I mean, you're reading it, we're nodding our heads here going, yeah, that's kind of how, well, be it at a much smaller scale than the guys at OpenAI and Claude and all the rest. But yeah, we're comfortable with that paragraph, Paul.
I think the interesting thing is Brett's good enough. Like, at what stage do you need something to be like amazing? And what stage do you really need it just to do a job? And I think we're getting really close to the space where it'll do the job that people expect it to do pretty well. Mm-hmm. And then there'll be the next frontier of innovation. It's like, well, it's doing what we expect. what next? Like, what's the next frontier of innovation in this space? Anyway, moving on to just a little bit of change in our format this week. I came across two reports that I'd like to bring to our listeners' attention. A recent report from Lenvi, Borrowers on the Brink, illuminates the growing significance of brand and trust in the realm of borrowing decisions, alongside the advancements in AI innovation, marking a shift from the prioritization of green credentials. It reveals a stark transformation from 2013, with borrowers now placing nearly as much emphasis on brand reputation as they do on interest rates when choosing a lender. So this change underscores the decline in the unilateral pursuit of favorable interest rates and highlights the emerging prominence of brand loyalty in lending decisions. Now, the surge in the popularity of buy now, pay later schemes represents a significant trend, favored especially among younger customers and overtaking credit cards among Gen Z. However, this trend does raise considerable concerns, particularly around the unregulated nature of buy now, pay later, its impact on vulnerable groups, and the challenges facing customers in managing multiple concurrent repayments. Notably, the report points to a disproportionate reliance on buy now, pay later among individuals with mental health conditions, cognitive disabilities, and ethnic minorities, suggesting a wider issue of financial exclusion and the appeal of buy now, pay later and its frictionless processes to these groups. I found this bit particularly telling. In today's fiercely competitive financial services market, the essence of trust and the value of a reputable brand are more crucial than ever. Borrowers seek assurance in lenders known for fair treatment, especially during turbulent times, indicating a blend of brand strength and competitive interest rates are going to be key to winning customer favor. Now, we followed this for some time, Cormac, and nearly every week, I think we mention buy now, pay later, the ongoing requirements to monitor conversations, which we've just gone through again, and the ability of those systems to adapt and learn. But when you look at buy now, pay later brands and their ability to do that intelligently, I think there's still a gap in the market for their ability to do that.
Yeah, there is, Paul. And if you look at buy now, pay later are in their current form, as we call them, is still very early, right? So the focus, as far as a buy now, pay later has been concerned about, has been selling their product, right? It's been getting, it's all front of sale. How do we get more of this out there? How do we get more traction? Top line. Eventually, it starts to filter down. Okay, what are the issues that this is creating? Some of it unforeseen, some of it seen, and how do we handle them, right? So the first thing is run as fast as we can and grow as quick as we can, and we'll deal with all the problems that and I say problems because they're not all major problems. It's just, you know, growing pains. And this is certainly one in terms of, as you say, monitoring the conversations and being able to change and learn depending on what the circumstances are of a customer. I think it is interesting that people are starting to put more weight into brand as opposed to cost. I mean, I would have pretty much always been in, everything else being equal, the cheapest interest rate loan is the one I'll go for, you know, everything else being equal. If people are now starting to make decisions on brand loyalty and not just interest rates, that has knock-on implications for originators and also for the buy now, pay later folks and how they deal with customers who get into financial difficulty. Because if they don't deal with them fair and equitably, they're not going to become repeat customers. You know, it's going to be buy now, pay later, and I'm done. That's it. So obviously, the success of these models requires repeat customers, and therefore you gotta treat people fairly when they get into difficulty. So a lot in that. I think they're gonna have to. I guess my original point is the investment has always been at the beginning of the funnel and selling your product, in this case, lending money. investment now has to look into the customer service support side of things, and how do we handle the after sales and everything that comes along with the after sales. And that's the area that hasn't had the investment up till now. And I think you're going to see that start to change.
You know, yeah, I think that's going to end up being super, super important.
Yeah, like, you know, typical things play into this metric-wise in terms of churn and lifetime value, and all of these things come into play here. You know, what are the unit economics of these buy now, pay laters, and how can they help improve those unit economics by engaging with technology throughout the customer journey? And that's what we're going to see as this space starts to evolve, you know.
Yeah, I think that I've kind of always been a little obsessed by payments and how easy they are or not. Mm-hmm. And I've even noticed lately that people I know, people in my house, our preferred method is a Revolut card now. Because it's just so much easier. It's instant. It's just like roll down to the person you want to pay or the service and pay. Yeah. And it's like, I will mention the Irish bank that I'm a customer of, but I'm a customer of that bank now for over 35 years.
And for those of you who are, for those of you,
torture.
You're not from, sorry to cut across here, Paul, but for those of you who aren't familiar with the Irish banking landscape, there's not that many of them there, particularly when it comes to retail banking. So I'm going to go out on a limb here, Paul, and say it's probably one of three, without mentioning any names. But anyway.
Probably one of two.
Two even, yeah.
But it's just the ease of payment is such an impact on what you choose and who you choose. If I had a choice, mm-hmm. of Revolut or this other bank during a checkout, I would pay every time with Revolut because it's just less, mm-hmm. frustrating. And I think that if I had to play with Klarna versus some other buy now, pay later, and I knew that, mm-hmm. by using Klarna, if anything went wrong or things needed to be follow up or I needed to ask questions, it's always super simple. I'd use Klarna, mm-hmm. because it's going to be less hassle. And I think that that element of the service is just going to become more and more important.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, just from a trust point of view here, just to see how much you trust Revolut. If you had, and I have no idea what Paul's personal circumstances are, folks, but if you had money that you were going to put on deposit, where would you put that money on deposit? With your traditional high street Irish bank, or would you put it on deposit with Revolut?
So I wouldn't have a ton of money. Like, I don't have like a ton of money to have on a deposit account anywhere.
Yeah, let's go hypothetically speaking.
Like, I don't think, like from a brand point of view, I don't feel there's a particular risk with having it with Revolut. Like, it's not, it would not enter as a factor. I just go, it's probably covered to X amount. I'd probably look that up and go, what are they covered until? Let's just say they're covered to 20 grand. I go, fine. I don't need any more than that. So I'm, you know, if it's covered under government and the other one's covered over government, then that's as good as it is. And I don't feel that the Irish bank is any more reliable or any more safe as banks after 2008. So yeah, I don't feel that they're safe as houses.
Now, as long as governments keep bailing them out, Paul, they probably are. I mean, if you look at what happened the last time, you know, the government essentially, well, it bailed out the two big ones. Yes, it let one go to the wall, but one could argue that anyway, we won't get into that discussion. I'm just wondering if Revolut went into difficulty, as the banks have done. You know, how would that stand, mm-hmm. in terms of a bailout? But we're probably getting a little bit off topic here. So
it's still covered under government. Well, it's got to do with the issue of how much do people know, how much do they investigate, and how much do they kind of feel. And I think that brands are all about what people feel. And if you feel that they're covered and you feel that they're trusted, you probably won't do a lot of research. I'm not saying that it's any less trustworthy. but it's brand. And how you feel about brands is really important. And if you see the Klarna brand up there and you see five other alternatives and you don't know the name of any of them, that is value. You will go with the Klarna brand because you recognize it. And that's just marketing 101 and has been for 100 years. Anyway, moving on to our final report. This one, Cormac, we said we'd come back to a few weeks ago. We said we'd do some more research. Very hard to get information about this, but this is AI for Business Success 2024 to 2025 from a company called Metric, M-E-T-R-I-Q. And I found this on No Jitter. It's a very reputable online space that covers developments in the communications industry. And this week it published an article on the jobs impact of AI on the contact center industry.
Ooh,
it was
nice.
A global research study into 679 companies, and they found that more than half of the companies, 55.7%, reduced the number of new agents they needed to hire. Those who did not use AI in the calendar year 2023 hired 89% more agents than those that did use AI. So some impact's coming through. Let's just follow this for a minute. In terms of existing employees, when AI is added to the contact center, 36.8% of companies laid off an average of 24% of their employees. Average handling time dropped by an average of 29.5% with the addition of agent assist. And while each supervisor saves nearly 2 hours a week when AI helps them with scheduling and planning, more than 80% of companies are increasing their AI spending in 2024, and the top reason cited by 75% of those companies is that they recognize the efficiencies AI brings. So they're investing in the technology, a move that is also reducing the total compensation for 37.8% of the companies. And that means lost jobs and fewer new hires in the contact center for many companies. Now, not all are reducing their contact center staff. 36% of the research study participants say they're experiencing a shortage of contact center agents. Of that group, 64% cited company growth as the top cause, followed by an inability to find the right people, 40%, or difficulty retaining existing staff, 35%, or a lack of budget to hire enough people. So that's 24%. When asked whether AI was helping them fill the gap between company growth and lack of agents to handle that growth, 84% said yes. So these companies are using AI to boost efficiency of agents that they do have on staff. They onboard new agents faster by using AI-powered training sprints throughout the first few months of work. And they increase the amount of fully automated customer interactions that they have. Now, more than half of companies are increasing the numbers of data analysts, security analysts, programmers, data scientists, and content managers, according to this research. They also expect to see some prompt engineering, the art of science of essentially programming prompts, to be a part of that set of skills. Now, that's a lot to take in. I know that's a big chunk of information there. But the two to the cap points here are, we are now starting to see the impact of AI in the contact center. It is starting to impact the amount of people that can be hired. It can impact the productivity of the people. And it is bridging that gap between the agents that you have and the workloads that you need to address. So very interesting to see that. And I'm definitely going to follow on and see, can I find more research to back this up? Because this is the really rubber hit the road territory now.
Yeah. You know, how do we put this? So we know we're seeing the impact that automation in particular, whether it's a fully AI driven or more simplistic, even decision tree type automation, we're seeing the impact that it has in the contact center, right? We've been seeing it for a number of years now. Not just since AI has become super cool and ChatGPT has emerged. This has started and will continue. You know, I think at the last count, where were we up to, like 75 or 76% of automation across our platform. So these are all conversations that would previously have been handled by a live agent in some shape or form, have now been automated. And it just by sheer numbers alone, and the impact that automation has and AI has, it cannot but impact the number of people working in the contact center industry. I mean, it's just logic will tell you that it's going to start filtering through. Look, we know too, Paul, it's extremely difficult to hire into the contact center. It's extremely difficult to retain staff, particularly in the credit and collections arena. You know, it's a difficult, those folks do a really challenging and difficult job. And if AI can handle, you know, a certain percentage of the conversations that humans were handling and automated, that's going to have a knock-on effect in terms of people needed in a contact center. Now, we're not at the point where we're going to decimate the contact center in terms of it as a source of employment. We're not, you know, quite at that yet. But I can't see any other curve coming here than one where we're going to see a decline.
Still on the opposite side of this.
Yeah, there's a lag.
I'm still on the opposite side of this. Yeah,
that's okay, Paul. You're allowed to be on the opposite side. You know, there always has to be someone who's right and wrong, right? So, you know, for every right person, there's. So, these things take time to filter through, right? So, you have the emergence of what AI can do and ChatGPT and all this automation, and there's a lag between that and adoption. And it starts off. Yeah, look, you know, we don't need to go through the adoption curve in terms of who adopts things first and then it filters through. But you can be fairly sure that the industry that we're in is towards the end of that tail in terms of adoption. But that is going to start happening now. And it will start impacting in the contact center. By looking at pure numbers, I can't see any other outcome.
I'm looking at this. I disagree. I'm going to quote you back from our own conversations last week in London, Cormac. There are a number of questions that can be asked fairly simply and answered fairly simply if they're automated correctly. Like, what's my balance? Can I move this to a different day? Can I have a new plan? And that takes up an awful lot of agents' time dealing with those. If you can automate those conversations, they go away. Okay, those conversations are automated away. Now look at that in line with the customer duty legislation. And then look at it with the sheer amount of people that need help that don't get it because you don't have the capability. And if you are able to sense and find that people are in difficulty, that you can explore a little bit, hand it over to an agent, and that agent can deal with the real messy bits of customers' lives, investigating, sensing, gaining an understanding of what that person's life might be. I think that in the medium term, that's where the effort is going to go. I think for every person you take off answering, where's my balance? And put them onto, let's explore like a little bit of what your finances look like and how we might be able to like rearrange your payment schedules to do that person to person with somebody and exhibit a duty of care to them. I think that's going to suck up an awful lot of the resources, human resources that are there anyway. So maybe the balance or the balance of skills might change from someone who's able to look up a balance to someone who's able to like deal with the emotional labor of dealing with someone in a very difficult circumstance. I think that balance of skills might change. You might need deeper and wider maturity to deal with it. But I still think that like the work will expand because when you see numbers like 50% of the people in the UK experience at some stage vulnerability, financial vulnerability, health vulnerabilities that affect their ability to pay bills or how they are emotionally resilient in the ability to deal with those bills. That number, the sheer number of people that you have to deal with, I think will fill that funnel really fast. So I'm still a little skeptical of the job losses.
So I think, and let's be clear here, there is always going to be a need for trained people in the contact center industry to handle those 60% cases or whatever they may be. I think for we see, well, we're talking about inbound contact here, right? So I think what we are seeing is about 40% of inbound contact in credit collections are handled by those, what's my balance, next payment date. Very automatable type queries that can be easily taken out of the contact center. My own take on it is that just by sheer numbers alone, that, and if you look at the makeup of a contact center today, the amount of people that are working in the vulnerability department as a percentage of overall is quite small, right? So I just don't see the shift being enough to take up the balance of the people who are going to be under threat. So, but look, a lot has to play out here yet, right? It's not, as I said, this isn't something that's gonna happen overnight, and there certainly is a lag, and it's gonna take some time.
Yeah,
but
I think the difficulty also, here, Cormac, sorry.
No, so there's a lag between us two, Paul. Yeah, I didn't mean a lag between us, but there is the last point to make. It's a very tight margin industry. The collections industry is extremely tight margins, and a lot of the costs are associated with HR, so with people. It's one that's consolidating, and it's one that is looking for ways to be way more efficient at what it does. So. Yeah. So look, let's tell you what, let's schedule a follow on conversation for 5 years' time and see what the metrics look like.
Hey, all this will be done and dusted by then. I'm just interested in, like, if I was a person in a BPO or with a large contact center or with a large customer service organization, I think getting a sense of the nature and speed of the disruption would be kind of something I'd like to get my hands on. Because this could tilt very fast, or it could take a long time to work its way through. And just again, for managing change, I think it's a good one to keep on the agenda, keep on the radar.
Absolutely.
Okay, folks, Cormac, thank you very much again for joining us this week. Always a pleasure to have you. And for everyone looking to follow up on any of the items we've discussed today, as always, they are contained in the episode notes. And if you are looking to find us, you will always find us at webio.com, where we update continuously with updated news and stories for the industry and indeed for Webio. Thank you for joining us. Meet us again next week, same time, this channel. Take care.